It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. This hour, race and justice. This is the sound of a demonstration here in Madison, just a couple of miles from our studio. All week, we've seen protests like this, ever since a white police officer shot and killed an unarmed African-American man, 19-year-old Tony Robinson. Now, Madison is not Ferguson, Missouri. The city has a progressive reputation, good schools, a high quality of life. But for the past couple of years, there have been some intense community discussions here about racial inequities that are hidden in plain sight. And maybe there are some lessons for other predominantly white cities. Steve Paulson sat down this week with Reverend Alex G. He's a community leader who grew up here, and with Erica Nelson, the lead author of a recent report on Madison's racial divide. The subject is personal for both of them. Alex raised his daughter here. Erica's got two biracial kids of her own.
How did each of you first hear about the shooting of Tony Robinson?
I was in Kansas City, Missouri last week for a conference. I was actually there giving a seminar about race relations, and we were actually talking about Ferguson because we were only about 3 hours away. And one of my coworkers sent me a text message and said, "You must not know what's happening in Madison." And so before I could write and ask what, I went to Madison.com, took a look at it, and just said, "Oh my gosh, no, not Madison. I can't believe this."
Erica, how did you first hear about this?
Well, I kind of live in the Near East Side neighborhood where the shooting took place, and I just happened to be home with some friends, and they said that there were many, many police cars in the street had been blocked off, and then began to get messages from friends who had said that there was a shooting of a young African-American man, and similarly was shocked.
Now, we should point out this is an ongoing investigation. There's only been limited information so far released to the public about the confrontation between Tony Robinson and the police officer who shot him. But what do people around the country need to know about this case at this time?
I think they need to know that people are horrified. Madison's a wonderful community. I've spent the majority of my life here. And this is just something that many of us thought would never and could never happen here.
Right. I mean, this seems like the city that's not like Ferguson, Missouri, the city with the national reputation. You know, it ends up on all these polls as a place that you want to live. We can talk about that reputation,
sure,
but this history of social and political progressivism.
Well, although I found this very difficult to believe, I've had several discussions with community leaders, with the police chief, with other police officers, and I said Madison actually is breeding ground for great disparity. And when you have that level of disparity, it only takes the fear in the heart of someone in leadership or police officer, the cockiness of a young person, and things could just really escalate.
Yeah, I was surprised by the reality of it, right? We are operating from a place of community conversations about race, conversations about policing and institutional and structural racism. Mm-hmm. And then in the midst of all of these conversations and a lot of positive progress, we have this event. And I think that is part of the shocking part, too, because the community as a whole over the last 18 months, 2 years, was really building momentum, having open discussions about race.
And this was fairly new, right? I mean, I know, Reverend G, you've been talking about these issues for years, but in terms of bringing these discussions of racial disparities in Madison to a citywide audience, that's really been just going on for a couple of years or so, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, in the work that we're doing with Justified Anger, we're finding reports that were written back in the 40s.
Right.
So they've been there, but people, I think, have been able to push them to the side because they've said this is Madison and that data doesn't compute.
I think it was sort of this culmination of the release of the Race to Equity report, which was quantitative accounts of the well-being of African-Americans versus whites in our county. And then Reverend G's article said, these aren't just numbers. This is really lived experience of African-Americans in the community.
Okay, saying, for people who haven't read the article, can you talk about it a little bit, Reverend G?
Sure. It was an article I wrote for Cap Times 2013, and I just talked about my experience being pulled over by the police in my church parking lot. I talked about mass incarceration at Downtown Rotary, and someone congratulated me afterwards for not being an angry black man. And I said, well, I am. And they continued to insist that I wasn't. And I left that meeting pondering, why was it so important for her to feel that I wasn't angry? I just talked about Wisconsin leading the nation in the incarceration of black men. And then I just started talking about the fact that many African-Americans are not at the decision tables. And when there are discussions about diversity, we're nowhere around, and just really gave my perspective on it. And I think I came out of hiding a bit because I felt that no one wanted to hear a middle class black male bemoan public life in Madison.
So what do we do with the reputation of Madison as being this progressive city? I mean, obviously, it's got all kinds of problems. How do we put these two things together?
Well, the race equity report, which was released in October of 2013, was sort of built upon the shoulders of other reports. And coupled with Reverend G's column and editorial, that sort of recatalyzed the conversation.
It put some numbers on a problem. And we should mention some of those numbers. I mean, they're startling. I mean, you found, for instance, that a quarter of the African-American community was unemployed compared to, 5% of Caucasians in Dane County. In 2012, black adults in Dane County were 8 times more likely to be arrested than white adults. That's stark.
It's extraordinary because when you look at Madison, Dane County, or the state of Wisconsin in the aggregate, we look great. You know, we make the top 10 lists of the best places to live. But when you disaggregate things by race, African-Americans here in Dane County were, on average, doing worse than African-Americans anywhere else in the nation. And I think that because Madison and Dane County has such a good reputation, that many of these issues that people were trying to bring up earlier in the past 3 decades sort of got brushed under the rug because it was in many ways easier to rely on the status quo of Madison's reputation than to address these stark disparities. And I think the other challenge here is that white well-being in terms of education and all these sort of indicators is better than the national average. And so the notion that a rising tide lifts all boats is not taking place here in our community.
And Reverend G, I'm guessing those numbers that the Race to Equity report revealed were not especially surprising to you.
No, because we recognize it and we talk about it. And so what do we do with our reputation? I think we take a hard look at ourselves to find out who we are really, because I think trying to protect an ideal or reputation that really wasn't accurate has hindered us from really becoming a very caring and inclusive and progressive community.
What do we need to talk about?
We need to talk about the systemic issues. If you look at systems or structures in our community that have tried to keep up with the changing demographics, the medical professions have not done that. Professors haven't done it. Media hasn't done it. Police have. That's one department, one workforce that you can look at and say it's really tried to keep up with the changing demographics. Judges haven't. Social workers haven't. So why aren't we attracting people? Why aren't we keeping people? What's really happening in the trenches?
So it does raise the question, why don't we attract a more diverse workforce in all these different professions you've just named?
We often talk about diversity. We don't want diversity in Madison. We want a Jackie Robinson. And that's not diversity. That's having the wherewithal to hit the ball out the park, but the stamina to deal with the name calling and to take your wife on the road with you, to experience all of that. So for a person to come to Madison, it's not just moving geographically, it's breaking the color barrier. You're the only one in your class, in your department, in your office, in your division, and you're the spokesperson. And they want to know why and how. And what they really want to know is, how did you get here and who did you know and what's your background and can I touch
your
hair?
What were your connections that allowed you to get
here? They're testing you to make sure that it wasn't some giveaway. And you have to deal with all of that and be able to handle it if you really want to be here. Whereas in other settings, you don't have to deal with all of that. Why do you dress that way? Why do you put this on? You know, just there's so many things that aren't cruel. It's not cross burning on your lawn. Just speaking personally, those kinds of offhand comments often said to me, we really see you as different.
So, Reverend G, you've lived in Madison for years. Ever thought about moving away?
All the time.
So why do you stay?
Because I understand the territory, I understand the environment, and I want to be a role model to children and to families who are trying to acclimate themselves to Madison. Madison's given a lot to me. So when I think of leaving, I realize it takes some resolve to make it better for the next family or for the next generation.
And I think, you know, to sort of build on what Reverend G has said, it's not cut and dry. It's actually kind of complicated because Madison provides a myriad of opportunities. And that's why people come. That's why people, white, black, Latino, come to Madison because of the quality of life. The question becomes for us now is, regardless of who you are, do you have equity of opportunity when you in fact arrive?
Sometimes my friends have looked at me in disbelief because they're saying, okay, you're the Huxtables. You're you know, you're the family on Black-ish. Come on. You don't understand disparity. But I see what's happening to people around me. I see people who are sharp and smart, who are struggling. But I think they'd be shocked to know that if my 18-year-old daughter were a son, I probably would have taken other job offers.
Hmm.
I don't know any African-American moms who aren't afraid for their sons. And not that their sons are going to go to the corner and buy a gun. They're afraid that they're going to be cut from a sports team so that they'll become a part of the subculture of the school and won't worry about eligibility and will start hanging out in front of the schools. And then with the unconscious biases, you see the kid, their skin color, their hair texture, and we automatically make some assumptions.
And I think just to sort of follow up on that, I think we have some unique circumstances here where, because the disparities in poverty, in child poverty, in unemployment are so stark, we have this sort of racialization of poverty because race and poverty or your level of education are so closely correlated in this community because the disparities are mm-hmm. so stark and because the African-American community is relatively small. You end up having circumstances where there are lower expectations based upon your skin color.
Hmm. I want to come back to the question of policing. Reverend G, you said earlier that the Madison Police Force is one case where there really has been diversity in the hiring. There are a lot of black police officers, and yet we've just had this this tragedy of the white police officer shooting and killing
sure.
a young man of mixed race. I mean, we don't know the circumstances yet. We'll still find out about
right.
that. And we've also heard that the police force here has taken steps to have racial mm-hmm. sensitivity training. I mean, it would seem like this is a police force that has done things right.
I personally think that racial sensitivity needs to go a step further. I just know human nature. I'm a diversity consultant. People are forced to take those things. It's when you hear that it's diversity day, or we're going to have the training, the eyes roll because people feel that they're going to be called racist and they're going to be given information that they don't need. And many people are just thinking, if you don't get in trouble, you don't have to worry about your race. And so the training is offered. But I'd want to ask, how do you measure its efficacy? How do you know that it's taking root? And isn't this evidence that perhaps some of the training that they're taking does not help with the unconscious biases as much as it really should?
Let me end with maybe practical solutions. I mean, if there's one thing in particular that we should do right now as a community, given what has just happened, we've just had this shooting in Madison. You've talked about all of the racial inequities that we have here. What's the one thing that you'd want our community to focus on right now, if there is one thing?
We'd have to focus on still having unity as a goal, to not let this become a huge setback. And that means even though we're having pain or experiencing turmoil, we can't lose all trust in humanity and each other. We can't revert back to 40 or 50 years ago and draw a strong dividing line and just say we can't trust anyone who's white, anyone who wears a badge, anyone who's a kid or wearing a hoodie and is black or of mixed race. I think we have to remind ourselves that this is one officer and this is not all police and this is not all Madisonians. This is one kid. This is not all kids. So I think we have to make sure that we don't lose sight that we have to live and live together beyond this. And we need to find ways to put ourselves in situations where we have to talk, grieve, and communicate. So putting a strong emphasis in continuing to talk together and live together and not become separated.
With Steve Paulson talking with Reverend Alex G. and Erica Nelson. She's the director of the Race to Equity Project. And by the way, this is the crowd singing Sunday night at a candlelight vigil for Tony Robinson. This story is personal for us because we live in Madison. In fact, our producer, Charles Monroe Kane, lives just a few blocks away from the house where Tony Robinson was shot. It's a pretty mixed-race neighborhood. Charles happens to be white, and the tragedy has been rippling through it. Here's how his family dealt with it.
My wife and I heard about Tony Robinson's death on Friday night. We didn't know what to tell our kids that weekend about all the protests, the candlelight vigils, the police barricades, all the TV vans that were filling our neighborhood. And then on Sunday, my son's fourth grade teacher told us that one of the kids in my son's elementary school was Tony Robinson's sibling. "It's a small school," she said. "The kids all know each other. There will be grief counselors at school on Monday, but she thought it'd be better if we told our son about Tony's death. Better for him to hear it from us instead of hearing it on the playground." So Sunday evening, we sat down with our son. He's 10 years old. He's big for his age, but I gotta be honest here. He looks so little sitting there on the edge of his bed. I don't exactly remember which words we used to tell him, that a brother of a kid in his school had been killed by a police officer, but I remember how much he cried. I don't quite know how we explained that the officer was white and the boy was black and unarmed, but we sat there, trying to explain racism to a 10-year-old. It's a hard enough thing for you and I to try to understand, let alone a kid whose only goal in life is building a city in Minecraft. My son wanted to know if he was safe. He really wanted to know if his best friend, who was black, was safe. We did our best to reassure him, but, you know? He went to school on Monday and didn't mention the grief counselors when he got home. He went to school on Tuesday, and I took him out for milkshakes, just him and me. I wanted to see how he was doing. That's when he told me about the fights. "Some of the kids are on the cop side," he said. "Some of the kids are on the black people's side," he said. "And there were fights after school, walking home, and on the playground." And my big boy was worried. He was worried that the teachers might take sides. What if there were so many fights that the principal had to get involved? What if the superintendent and the school board, maybe even the governor, had to stop the kids from fighting? Maybe school would close. Maybe even the president would have to do something. But it wouldn't cause a world war or anything. He knew that was too far, too much. But it was really, really tense at school, he said. I didn't know how to help him. What was I going to say? And then he told me that he and a bunch of other kids came up with a kind of solution on their own. They agreed to stop telling mean jokes until after spring break. They'd hold off on the cutdowns that are so popular with fourth graders. "You're so ugly that," or "yo mama is" jokes. "They're not racist or anything," he said, "but maybe if we don't tell jokes for a while, things won't be so tense." And then he said, "You gotta do something, right, Dad?"
That's to the best of our knowledge producer, Charles Monroe Kane. Coming up, journalist Jill Leovi takes us to the streets of South Los Angeles to give us an inside look at some of the challenges homicide detectives are facing. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about race and justice in this hour. When a white cop kills an African-American man, it makes headlines, at least some of the time. But in many black neighborhoods, murder happens all the time and hardly ever makes the news. In 2006, journalist Jill Leovi started a blog called The Homicide Report. Her goal was to document every murder committed in L.A. County, and there were about 1,000. She spent 2 years embedded with homicide detectives, talking with victims' families, witnesses, and suspects. In her new book, Ghetto Side, a true story of murder in America, she writes about how difficult some of those conversations were.
I don't know why some things get to me more than others, but in my book, I talk about the father of one of the main victims I discuss in the book, who's a homicide detective, a black homicide detective who's lost his son. He says to me in the course of reporting the book, it's something that he hadn't admitted earlier, which is that he lived in a high crime area, partly out of a sense of duty, that he believed a police officer should live in the community that he polices. And that completely undid me. That was one of the hardest things I've ever taken in one of these interviews for some reason. I guess it felt to me that it so implicated the whole city.
This reminds me of one of the moments in the book. You're describing an L.A. homicide detective, John Skaggs, is walking into the home of a woman named Barbara Pritchett, and her son, Devon Harris, has been murdered. I don't know, maybe you could describe that scene.
And he gives her the shoes of her son, which have been in an evidence locker. Paramedics generally take off shoes when they take people in an ambulance. And so they were at the crime scene. He brings them back to her in a box a year later when the case is ready to go to trial. And she smells the interior of the shoe. She holds it up to her face to get the stink of her son's feet in the shoe. And as she catches that smell and remembers him, and she collapses.
You focused a lot on the detective in that case, who had to just stand there while she cried, and he's had to do that kind of thing a lot. So tell us about him, this guy John Skaggs. Why did you decide to focus on him?
By that time, I had very concrete ideas about the thesis of the book and what I wanted to explore, and that was specifically the vigor of the state's response to violence. And so he was somebody who really personified that, and particularly personified that in the case that I explore, in the murder of a colleague's son. So he's a highly energetic individual. He's a supremely confident individual. I say in my description of him that he's quite full of himself, but his arrogance is internal. It's no one else sees him as being particularly distinguished. He doesn't occupy a high position in the police department. He's not working in a division or precinct that's considered sort of central to the city's activities. It's kind of a backwater.
And we should mention that he's white.
And he's white. He works in Watts. And he's had years and years to kind of toil against this very high caseload, the high volume of cases, very consistent types of cases where it's black-on-black homicides, lots of them summed up as gang violence with reluctant witnesses. And so he becomes a real specialist in this particular kind of murder, which I argue is the plurality. It's the big concentration of murders in America, what we should be massing our best forces against, but what tends to end up being kind of marginal homicides simply because they're not the public's focus.
So let's talk about this one. The main case that you focus on and you follow Skaggs through this involves the young guy named Bryant Tonelli. He's walking down a street in South L.A. It's a warm spring evening, 2007. What happened?
A car pulls up in the corner. A young assailant jumps out of the car and points a gun and shoots him. He falls on the lawn, and somebody near the scene runs a couple blocks away and gets his father, Wally Tonelli, who's an LAPD homicide detective. The father drives over and ends up being the first detective on the scene. Mm. He sees his son lying there as the paramedics are gathering. So,
wow. Why was Bryant Tonelli murdered? Was he targeted, or was it more of a case of wrong place, wrong time?
This is something about homicide. First of all, a lot of homicides aren't solved, and so you never really know what happens. But even if they are solved, my experience of people who are convicted of killing other people is that they don't reveal a whole lot. It's hard to really tell. They don't always tell the truth. And so in this case, we really don't know. I mean, what we do know is that Bryant had no criminal record. He was not in a gang. He was probably an easy target because of where he was living and what he was wearing. It's really hard to get good solid narratives out of people in situations like this.
You've spent a lot of time on both sides now. You've spent a lot of time with the police detectives. You've spent a lot of time in particular neighborhoods talking with families and witnesses. Where does communication break down between these two groups of people? They both care about crime. What is it they're not understanding about each other?
It's amazing the intersection points. They're in agreement about a lot. You know, there is a ton of work that can be done with conduct, with just the way police talk to people. But in general, I would say that this is bigger than the police department or the so-called communities that they work in. I think that a general public mindset that the police should be predicting or preventing crime is actually more of the culprit here than even some of the very counterproductive attitudes that you sometimes see within police departments.
What do you mean?
All through the 90s and into the 2000s, what was it that was forming the contours of police bureaucracies? Well, it was the COPS program. It was getting more uniforms on the street. It was saturation policing. It was targeted policing. It was broken windows. It was sort of this, I think, really unexamined idea that it's a great thing to police with data and to target neighborhoods and saturate them with uniformed officers without really asking, well, what are those uniformed officers doing when they go to the neighborhood to saturate it, to respond to crime, to respond to data? Well, of course, they're just stopping and searching people, as opposed to standing back and saying, you know, really what police are doing is enforcing the law. What is law? Why do we need it? How do we build it? And that's the reason I focus on violent crime in my book and the response to violent crime, because in terms of building legitimacy, that is the state's first job, is to catch killers. And that has not been the public discussion. It's not been our discussion as a nation around this problem.
So would you suggest that a better policy would be to lighten up on the preventive work, lighten up on checking on the windows and respond and searches, and instead double down on trying to solve unsolved homicides?
Probably in the real world, this is a continuum. Probably in the real world, there's always going to be a balance between preventive and what I call responsive policing and what others would call reactive policing. But what I would say is it's absurd to expect things to get better in a neighborhood where, as in the case of South Los Angeles, there were from the late 80s to about 2005, 2006, the last time I did this analysis, 40 unsolved homicides per square mile, with some blocks having 3 unsolved homicides in a dozen years and a single intersection on east of the 110 freeway that had had 8 homicides in 12 years, all of them unsolved. When those are the facts on the ground, when that's the environment, you cannot build an effective legal structure. You cannot let those things go.
Why aren't those murders being solved?
The solve rates are, to be generous, probably around half, maybe a little more than half, but it's just not enough. In some of the wealthy countries of Western Europe, they have 80-90% solve rates for homicide. If we're lumbering along down in the 50s and the 60s, especially when crime is so concentrated, especially when we still have so much hypersegregation, which sort of amplifies everything, you're just not going to get there. You're not going to get to building a lawful environment.
Jill Leovi is a reporter for the LA Times and author of Ghetto Side, a true story of murder in America. Brian Stevenson grew up in a poor black neighborhood in Delaware, and he wound up at Harvard Law School. When he graduated, he headed south to Alabama because he wanted to use his law degree to help the victims of the criminal justice system. Prisoners on death row, children incarcerated in adult prisons, people unfairly tried and wrongfully convicted, most of them poor and black. For decades, Brian Stevenson's been fighting judges and prosecutors and police on behalf of the disenfranchised. Archbishop Desmond Tutu calls him America's young Nelson Mandela. Now he's written a stunning memoir called Just Mercy, a story of justice and redemption. Steve Paulson talked with him.
Brian, one of the most remarkable cases that you've written about involves a man named Walter McMillan, who was on death row for a crime he didn't commit. What was he accused of doing?
He was accused of committing a murder that took place in downtown Monroeville, Alabama. And it was a young woman who was white, who was from an affluent family. And the crime really unsettled the community because it took place right in downtown Monroeville and the police couldn't make an arrest. There was a lot of disruption, a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear and anger. And 6 months after the crime had taken place, when they had no leads, you could hear people whispering about the competence of the sheriff and the district attorney. And so there was enormous pressure on law enforcement to make an arrest.
And so why was Walter arrested?
Well, this is where it gets very interesting. Walter McMillan was a 45-year-old African-American with no prior crime history. He was not somebody you would suspect of committing a murder. All we could identify that brought Walter to the attention of these folks was that he was having an affair with a young white woman. And we believe that's what provoked some people to target him. And he was eventually arrested and charged with this murder, even though, at the time of the crime, he was raising money for his sister's church about 11 miles from the crime scene, surrounded by 30 other African Americans who could all vouch for his presence at this house 11 miles away. The sheriff was so determined to make an arrest that they just ignored all of that and then really tried to demonize him. They put him on death row before the case ever went to trial. It's the only case I've ever worked on where the client was actually placed on death row for 15 months before trial. And of course, that meant that the press would say death row defendant Walter McMillan will be arraigned, or death row defendant Walter McMillan has filed these kinds of pretrial pleadings. And it really painted him in this dangerous way. It was a really, really outrageous case. And of course, the ultimate irony is that Monroeville, Alabama, is where the famed novelist Harper Lee grew up.
Right. And where she wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, which is all about correcting racial injustice.
Exactly.
How were you able to get Walter's conviction overturned?
We eventually were able to show that the state had withheld exculpatory evidence that they obviously should have disclosed. The witnesses all recanted. And when we got all of the witnesses to recant, the Alabama Bureau of Investigation did another investigation and agreed with us that Mr. McMillan was innocent and all the charges were dismissed, but not without real cost to Mr. McMillan. He spent 6 years on death row, you know, was there when 8 people were executed, and it haunted him for the rest of his life. He talked about being able to smell the flesh burning when people were electrocuted in the electric chair, and it was obviously devastating to have an entire state trying to kill you day after day, week after week, month after month.
This has to be quite unusual, this kind of case. But are there a lot of wrongful convictions?
It's shocking how frequently this takes place. For every 9 people who have been executed in America, we've now identified 1 innocent person on death row who's been exonerated. There have been over 150 exonerations of innocent people on death row. It's a shocking rate of error. I don't think any of us would tolerate this kind of error in any other area of public life. I know that in the aviation industry, if for every 9 planes that took off, 1 crashed and everyone died, nobody would fly. It just would be unacceptable. Yet we have tolerated the kind of error that we've seen in too many jurisdictions.
You have also represented kids, I mean, children as young as 13, who were, in some cases, sentenced to life in prison without parole. And you tell a story about one boy, I think he was 14 at the time, named Charlie. What was he in jail for?
Yeah, that was one of my early cases, a really tragic case of a child who was living in a house where his mother was repeatedly the target of a lot of domestic violence. This boy's mother had a boyfriend that would start drinking and just become violent. And one day the man had been drinking, came home, came into the kitchen, walked up to the boy's mother, punched her in the face, knocked her unconscious. And this little boy was trying to get his mom to wake up. And after 10 minutes of trying to revive his mom, she was covered with blood, and the little boy thought his mom was dead. And the man had gone into a bedroom and fallen asleep, so the little boy got up, walked into the bedroom, opened a dresser drawer, pulled out a handgun, and then walked over to where the man was sleeping. The man was snoring, and when the man stopped snoring, the little boy tragically pulled the trigger, shot the man in the head, and he died instantly. Child was about 5 feet tall. He was under 100 pounds. He was only 14. And he was the kind of kid who might have been tried as a child, but for the fact that the man that he shot and killed, his mother's boyfriend, he was a deputy sheriff. And because of his status, the prosecutor insisted that this child be prosecuted as an adult and was immediately placed in the adult jail. And that's where I'd met him for the first time after he'd been there for 3 days. And it was heartbreaking because I couldn't get this child to say a word. He just kept staring at the wall. And eventually I got up and I walked around the table and pulled my chair close to him and said, look, I can't help you if you don't talk to me. You got to talk to me. He wouldn't say a word. And there was a point at which I just started leaning on him because I couldn't figure out what else to do. And when I did that, this little boy leaned back. And when he leaned back, I put my arm around him and said, come on, talk to me. And this child began to cry. And through his tears, he began talking to me, not about what happened with the man, not about what happened with his mom. But he started talking about what had happened at the jail. And he told me on the first night he'd been hurt by several men. He told me on the next night he'd been raped by several people. He told me on the night before I'd gotten there, so many people had hurt him, he couldn't remember how many there had been. And I held this little boy while he cried hysterically, you know, for almost an hour. And when I left that jail, I couldn't help but think, who is responsible for this? And I realized we are. We've allowed our society to put children in these imperiled places behind a narrative that's false and incomplete, behind our anger and fear. All children are children, but our laws don't reflect that. We try to treat children as adults when they're not. And it set me on a path that has resulted in us challenging in a pretty aggressive way the prosecution of children as adults. We've been to the Supreme Court a couple of times and won some cases that have created some relief for kids prosecuted as adults, but there's still a lot more work to be done.
Is there anything you could do to help this boy, Charlie?
We got him out of that jail immediately, and I write in the book about a wonderful family that ultimately got involved with him, and I'm happy to report he's doing really well. We were able to get him out after a relatively short period of time, and he's doing really well. But obviously, that's a lifelong burden to have to bear. And even as we speak, there are some 10,000 children in the United States in adult jails or prisons. There are about 28 states that still allow kids 17 and younger to be placed in adult jails or prisons where they have no sight or sound separation from adults. And they're about 8 times more likely to be the victims of sexual assault and about 11 times more likely to attempt suicide.
There's so many issues at play here. One is, I mean, the obvious injustice in the criminal courts. I mean, as you've described, some of these cases, for instance, of wrongful conviction or just sort of horrible treatment of people. There's also just the kind of conversation that it seems like we need to have about race and justice in this country. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on what we can do about that, how we can talk about this.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I do think we've practiced silence about these issues for too long. Many countries that have tried to recover from gross violations of human rights have recognized that there has to be truth and reconciliation. You can't ignore what's happened. We haven't done that. We never in this country talked about slavery and the distortions created by the narrative of racial difference that slavery represented. For me, the great evil of slavery was not involuntary servitude. It was this ideology of white supremacy that we created to legitimate slavery.
It seems like we have talked about slavery, though. I mean, it's in all of our history books, but you're saying we haven't had, what, the real conversation we need to have about it?
Yes, and I don't think actually what's in our history books represents the true evil of slavery. I mean, if you live in my part of the country, I'm sitting here in Montgomery, Alabama, where 2 years ago there were 59 monuments and markers to the mid-19th century. We celebrate the Confederacy in this region of the country. In this state, Jefferson Davis's birthday is a state holiday. A Confederate Memorial Day is a state holiday. It's not Martin Luther King Day. It's Martin Luther King / Robert E. Lee Day. And we've romanticized the mid-19th century, and we've glorified it, and we haven't said a word about slavery. If you came here 2 years ago, you wouldn't find a word about it. And so I don't think we've actually confronted the legacy of that narrative. In my view, slavery didn't end in 1865. It evolved. And that's not something we've talked about, because we were compromised by this difference, this narrative, this ideology, this racial hierarchy for decades. And that's why we then had lynching, and that's why we had convict leasing. That's how we got to segregation and the need for a civil rights movement. And we still haven't talked about the narrative of racial difference. We've never had truth and reconciliation. And because of that, I think we are still compromised by our failure to deal honestly with this issue. If you go to Germany, you are forced to deal with the legacy of the Holocaust. There are monuments and markers everywhere.
What would you want us to do? I mean, how should we be dealing with this history?
Well, we're starting in Montgomery. So I mentioned how there were all of these monuments and markers to the Confederacy and nothing about slavery. We erected 3 markers to the slave trade, and we put them in public spaces with great resistance. The Alabama Historical Association didn't want us to do it. They said it would be too controversial. But I think that's a healthy step forward. I want to mark the spaces where lynchings took place. I want to mark the spaces where people suffered from segregation. I think we ought to create enough truth about our history that we begin to think and talk about what reconciliation requires. And this isn't just an issue for people of color. You know, we've got a generation of people in this country who were taught that they're better than other people because of their skin color. And that's a kind of abuse in my judgment. And if we're not doing things to correct that, we're going to see the implicit bias that plays out day in and day out.
Brian Stevenson founded the Equal Justice Initiative in Alabama. He's a MacArthur Genius Award winner and author of Just Mercy, a story of justice and redemption. He talked with Steve Paulson. Coming up, a documentary filmmaker spends a year in Mississippi investigating the murder of a white supremacist. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about race and justice in this hour. John Safran is an Australian filmmaker and prankster who once traveled from Melbourne to Mississippi in search of a white nationalist. He was looking for the self-proclaimed founder of the American Skinhead Movement, a guy named Richard Barrett. Now, not only did Safran interview the man, he also managed to sneak a DNA sample off of him, had it analyzed, and then announced the results publicly at Barrett's Whites Only Spirit of America Day banquet.
At this time, we'd like to thank the Australian Television, which is here covering the banquet and the Spirit of America Day. And John, if you'll come up.
He wanted to say a few words of appreciation. John, we're honored to have you.
Well, thank you to the people of Mississippi, and congratulations to all the participants in the Spirit of America Awards. Now, this is a bit awkward, but yesterday when I interviewed you, Richard, I procured a saliva sample and I took it to a DNA testing plant, and the results are in, as they say, and there's no real easy way to put this, but you have African DNA. You're part African. But don't worry, it's not like you're black, it's more you're white and a bit black, like Barack Obama. But it doesn't really matter, because like we're all mixed up, all of us. Like, if we went back far enough, I probably wouldn't even be Jewish. Anyway, thank you, everybody, and enjoy the Spirit of America banquet.
So from here, the story gets even more complicated. A year later, Richard Barrett was murdered. A young black man named Vincent McGee was accused, and John Safran couldn't resist going back to Mississippi to investigate. The result is a book called God'll Cut You Down, The Tangled Tale of a White Supremacist, a Black Hustler, a Murder, and How I Lost a Year in Mississippi. Doug Gordon talked with John Safran.
John, why did you want to travel to Mississippi to investigate the murder of Richard Barrett?
Because I'd spent 2 days with the guy who ends up getting murdered. That's a pretty rare thing. And, you know, there's all these archetypes that seem like there will be substance to them. White supremacist, young black man. And then one of the first stories that came through is that the young black guy called Vincent McGee, he was about 22. His initial story to the investigators was that Richard Barrett, the white supremacist, had sexually attacked him and he had to fight him off. And one thing led to another, and that's why he ended up murdering Richard Barrett.
Yeah. You mentioned that Vincent McGee said that Richard Barrett had sexually attacked him. Was that the only theory, or were there other theories about McGee's motivation for murdering Barrett?
Well, it could have been over money, because Vincent McGee did yard work for Richard Barrett, and Richard Barrett, as I found out, was infamous for scamming people. For instance, I tracked down white workers who'd worked for him who were like just like furious because they'd fixed his house or whatever, and they were still chasing money off him years later. So it could have been just a fight over money where Vincent just felt exploited having worked for Richard and not getting paid.
Or not getting paid enough, right?
Yes. People just thought also, hey, young black guy, a white supremacist, how can this not be about race? Maybe Richard Barrett was racist to him or something, and that caused Vincent to strike him. But there were so many curious, weird things about this case that just didn't fit into easy archetypes. One of them was that Vincent McGee apparently didn't know that Richard Barrett, who he was working for, was an infamous white supremacist. Huh. And which sort of made sense, because Richard was from a bygone era. He was this guy who'd always be the go-to guy if you wanted the crazy white supremacist to be in your article or on your TV show or whatever. They never quite trusted him. Why is this New Yorker here trying to set up a Mississippian white supremacist group? So he was sort of never quite accepted even within the white supremacist scene in Mississippi. They all sort of suspected he was gay, but they didn't quite speak about it. One of the real interesting things I discovered there was amongst the white community in general, like the conservative white community, but even amongst some of the white nationalist community, it was if you were gay but didn't speak about it and everyone knew you were, but you just kind of kept it to yourself and didn't flaunt it, you could live life and those people wouldn't bring it up. I kind of discovered that in the black community that Vincent was part of, it was more taboo to be gay there than it was in the white nationalist community there. One of the stories that came out is perhaps Vincent McGee, the young black man, was getting paid for sex with Richard Barrett, the white supremacist. So, you know, Vincent was totally complicit in the whole thing. And when I spoke to his mother, she was really concerned and she really wanted to make it clear, like nothing else, that Vincent isn't gay.
What happened at Vincent McGee's trial?
He pled guilty, so there was no trial. And he accepted 65 years jail. So that was like really weird.
Yeah, why do you think he did that?
Yeah, it's like, why wouldn't you just roll the dice? Anything could happen. And there was a local lawyer there, this white guy who was kind of helping me along when I was there. And he said, you know, in this county, people might be sympathetic to a person having to fight off a gay attack. It's not a sure thing that even a white conservative jury would definitely go against Vincent McGee, even though he was black or whatever. One explanation for why he accepted 65 years jail rather than roll the dice, because by that point, the death penalty had been taken off the table. And one theory is that Vincent didn't want it dragged into the spotlight in a court case that he'd been paid for sex from anyone, and but particularly a prominent white supremacist in Mississippi.
Actually, we're able to have several phone interviews with Vincent McGee while he's in jail. Can you tell me about those?
I sent a letter pretty early on and he wasn't getting back to me, and he did after several months. Out of the blue, I got a phone call from him. It took me a while to even understand him because he spoke with such a slur. Also, he was ringing from a cell phone in prison and he'd be cut out all the time. I'd just get random calls from him, usually when he needed something from me. In fact, always when he needed something from me, mainly Walmart Green Dot cards, which are like these gift cards that you read out the numbers on the back to them that served as a currency in prison.
How much did you spend?
I reckon a couple of thousand.
Wow.
Just the right amount for both sides to be annoyed at me. If you think it's wrong to pay a killer, then I'm a jerk. And then if you think he's in a really bad situation and I'm writing a book, then I'm a jerk. There's sort of like no way around it, really.
So how do you view yourself? You mentioned some people may think you were a jerk for doing that. How do you view the ethics of doing that?
First of all, I announce it in the book. That would be almost like the only thing that I'd have a problem with. I mean, my guess was he was like spending the money on things like cigarettes. And so I didn't really have a problem with the fact that someone who's stuck in this awful situation in the prison system, regardless of what he did, I didn't like really have a problem that my money's going towards him having these little luxuries like cigarettes or whatever.
Vincent actually threatened you at one point, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Like the first couple of times I paid him and he didn't really cough up enough information, I felt, for my story. I was like, oh, whatever. But after a while, I was just like, oh, screw this. I said, listen, don't tell your story. That's fine. But you can't expect me to pay you and then not tell your story. But if you don't want to talk, that's fine or whatever. It was a point where I was just like, I was not going to pay him. And he just got furious straight away and just threatened to have me killed that night. And I was like, how does this impact on what I now think about him and Richard Barrett? Because Richard Barrett was probably killed. He was like in a house and probably held back on money from Vincent McGee and then ended up with a knife in his throat. So it's like Vincent was really playing out with me, you know, in some ways, things that had happened on the night.
Do you think he was serious when he threatened?
Oh, yeah, I think he was serious but impotent. I was sort of scared a little. Like, I checked the locks. I remember it well. But by that point, I knew he was a bit of a fantasist or a fabulist or whatever. And I kind of thought he didn't really have the pull to, like, drag together a posse to have me killed. I sort of felt I was the one guy in Mississippi that was even, like, talking to him. So I wasn't, like, incredibly threatened. And in that way, he was a mirror of Richard Barrett, because Richard Barrett also, like, big noted himself as this white nationalist leader. And when you dug a little deeper, it's like, really, was he? Like, how many people actually followed him? And Vincent was like that too, where he big noted himself as this gang leader. And in both cases, I thought there was a bit of emperor having no clothes.
Yeah. Did you want Vincent to be a hero?
Oh, yeah, definitely. When I first went there, I wanted it to be really simple. I wanted it to be me and Vincent McGee and his black lawyer and his family. Like, it's us, we're this little team, and we're going against the racist state and the racist prison system. That's true. It's not like that's not in the story of Mississippi and in the story of this case, but it's just so much messier than that. Vincent's no angel. Even though it was about race in a manner, it was about other things as well. And so, yeah, he definitely wasn't the sort of like Nelson Mandela character I kind of wanted him to be when I arrived there.
John Safran is the author of God'll Cut You Down, The Tangled Tale of a White Supremacist, a Black Hustler, a Murder, and How I Lost a Year in Mississippi. He talked with Doug Gordon. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced today's show with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, Raymond Tungekar, and Craig Ely. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.